Tonight's Health and Happiness features a recording of a recent mental health event. On the evening of Thursday, April 27th, 2023, a symposium titled Mental Health Resources and Research, a Community Symposium, was held on the Montana State University campus at Norm Asbjornsen Hall's Inspiration Hall. The symposium featured a panel of mental health experts speaking about mental health topics, including current issues for college-age students, rural mental health resources and workforce development, psychopathology, addiction, and neuropsychiatric medicine. The symposium was co-sponsored by the League of Women Voters of the Bozeman area and MSU's Department of Research and Economic Development. The event was recorded by Rick Martinez and Drs. Arliss and Suzanne Wood. We'll broadcast the panel discussion tonight. There was a Q&A session following that will be part of next week's Health and Happiness episode.
Okay, I would like to say welcome to our community symposium, Mental Health Resources and Research. Thanks for being here. This symposium is going to mark the beginning of the revival of our Center for Mental Health Research and Recovery here at MSU. For the past 6 months or so, we've been assessing our capacity and strengths to host this center, and we've changed in the last 8 years. But I'm really encouraged by what I've found, and I think we're going to be able to do this well. So we will kick it off tonight. We will probably search for a director of our center starting this summer. And so if you have any ideas about that, you can send them my way. I'm Allison Harmon, and I'm the Vice President for Research here at Montana State University. And I'm happy you're here. I'm happy our panelists are here. I want to welcome them. I'm just going to say a few words about our panelists, be brief, so that they have more time to share their expertise with us. And I want to give a couple reminders as well. One is that we have some cue cards and pens on the tables for you to write questions for our panelists. We have folks here who are going to collect those questions and bring them up to me so I can read them. They have to be read into this microphone in order for it to be recorded on our WebEx machine here. And if you're listening online, so we have another audience that is on our WebEx listening remotely, and they can ask a question too by writing something in the chat. We are also being recorded by KGVM Radio right over here. Thank you for being here. They will be broadcasting in slightly edited version, right? Cutting out all of my silliness on the radio next couple weeks. You'll also be able to listen to it on their radio station, kvm.org. So thank you. Yeah. Okay, I think I've said enough, and I will just say a few words about our panelists, and then this is how this will go. Each of our panelists will take about 10 minutes to talk about the highlights of their work. And then in the second hour, we will take your questions. I have a few questions up here as well, but we'd love to know what you're curious about. So you can be writing your questions on cue cards in the next hour. Okay, time to put my glasses on so I can read. First panelist is Dr. Betsy Asserson. She is the Director of our Counseling and Psychological Services here at MSU. She's also a practicing licensed psychologist, and she's shared her leadership as a co-chair of the Montana University System Suicide Prevention and Mental Health Task Force. So, thank you, Betsy. Dr. Rebecca Coltz is Department Head and Professor of Counseling in Health and Human Development here at MSU. She's a licensed counselor, and she works to understand counselor development, as well as preparation of counselors for rural counseling appointments. Dr. Brandon Scott is our Associate Professor of Psychology, and his research is informed by models of resilience and risk in youth. And then Dr. Bob Seiss is here, and he is CEO and co-founder of 406 Recovery. He's also served as the Chief Medical Officer of the Greater Montana Region's largest psychiatric practice to help ensure that Montanans have access to quality psychiatric treatment services and crisis care. So thank you, Dr. Seiss. And then we do not have our fifth panelist online yet, but we hope that he appears. He's in New York. This is Dr. Kushner. He is an MD and also a PhD in neuroscience. He's a professor in the Department of Psychiatry at Columbia University. He's also a psychiatrist and research scientist for the New York State Psychiatric Institute, and he co-directs a Center for Precision Psychiatry and Mental Health in New York. So he will be joining us, we hope, soon. And we hope that we can hear him just fine. So why don't we kick it off? I'll let Betsy get started, and I will step away from the microphone, and then you can just pass it up.
Sounds good. Thank you, everyone. Nice to meet you all. Betsy Asserson, as Allison said, I use she, her pronouns, and I'm really grateful to Allison and everyone who helped make this event happen tonight. I think one of the things I'm really excited about when Allison is talking about the relaunching of the Center for Mental Health Research and Recovery, and when you heard a little bit about the differing areas of interest and different things that we all do, is really how it's grounding us in there's not one size fits all or one path to how we address mental health, right? There really are all of these different pieces that I think are really critical. And so I'm excited to hear what my colleagues have to say today and all those different pieces about how we're talking about and working in mental health in various ways. I am the director, as Allison said, of the Counseling and Psychological Services here on campus. And so what I'm going to talk about is some of the work we do here on campus and providing mental health care to students, and a little bit about how we take a holistic approach to that and what that's looking like on our campus and what we're seeing with the trends in college students and mental health, because there's a lot emerging that we're starting to see and notice in how college students are experiencing mental health issues and challenges. So as the director of the Counseling Center, a little history of how counseling centers work. I've actually spent most of my professional career working in college counseling. I didn't think that was the path I was going to go down. And I had my first practicum experience at a university counseling center in Pittsburgh when I was a graduate student. And I thought I would do that practicum to get to what I really wanted to do, which was probably community mental health or inpatient. And I fell in love with working with college students. And what I fell in love with was the fact that it's such a pivotal time developmentally for people as they're going through many changes. They're finding themselves, they're learning about themselves, and it's also the time where we start to see the emergence of some pretty significant mental health issues sometimes. What I learned was that one of the great ways to support people in that time is that access to resources is critical. So university counseling centers provide, I think, a really unique opportunity for people who are going through that emergence of mental health issues, or maybe they've never had the ability to access care previously. And usually in counseling centers, that's that first time where they have the ability to, on their own accord, go in and start services, have that confidentiality, and really start to work on things. It's not uncommon for us to hear about people who have maybe experienced depression or anxiety for a long time, and they finally get to MSU and they think, now I can finally go in and talk to someone and have that access and have that confidentiality, which I think is really critical. One of the things that I think is also unique about what we do on counseling centers is also incorporating that outreach and prevention lens. So as we're all going to talk about these different pieces, one of the things I really think about is how do we intervene and start to use those outreach and prevention efforts to help people learn new skills? How do we identify people who might be at risk of developing mental health issues, and how do we get them to that support? So that's another, I think, critical piece of this comprehensive model that we use within counseling centers to support students in how they can access care. For us, that really starts before students even enroll. So students come to campus for visits to campus. We do presentations to them. We're talking about mental health. We're talking about resources. We're doing everything we can to normalize that discussion from the very start, when they're even considering starting college. As we start to have those conversations, our hope is that stigma can reduce for people and they feel more comfortable seeking care or talking to each other and talking to their peers. At MSU, I think we've done a really great job of trying to create a culture of support among all of our campus community. So faculty and staff and students are trained to be able to identify when someone might be at risk and how to have those conversations. that's where that public health approach, I think, is really critical, where people have that opportunity to engage and to identify when someone might be struggling and get them the help that they need. I'm going to spend most of my time kind of talking about what we're seeing in terms of the clinical needs in the college population and how that's emerging on our campus as well as nationally. So within our clinical model, we take an integrated approach where we're integrated with our medical services. So taking that integrated behavioral health approach where we're working closely with primary care and medical providers in a more holistic approach to mental health care with students when they're presenting. We have an embedded behavioral health psychologist within our medical services department, and we do universal screenings within medical services. So thinking about how do we identify these students early on and help connect them with different types of care. Within the counseling center, we provide ongoing counseling and individual treatment. That's sort of our bread and butter, what everyone thinks about when they think of our office. But we also do a lot of crisis intervention service. We have walking crisis services all day, every day. And that has been something I've really seen shift over my time in this role, is that we're seeing more and more students who are presenting with that higher level of distress and needing those more crisis-type services related to suicidality, usually is what that looks like when they're coming through the doors for those crisis services. And then we also provide group counseling services for students. So we know a lot of students might benefit from being in a group therapy program with their peers. We have 10 groups this spring, 10-ish, if I'm remembering correctly. So really looking at ways for students to engage with each other with a practitioner facilitating that group to find that support and connection and access treatment in that way. Those are kind of our critical pieces of our clinical model. And then training is the last pillar that I kind of wanted to talk about related to some of the work in the counseling center. We have an APA-accredited doctoral internship program, which some of the work that, as people are just tracking on what's going on with mental health, we know that workforce issues are pretty critical. And we're lucky to have a program on campus that is training future counselors. In our office, we do the clinical training for both master's and doctoral students, and that's really important that we're investing in the workforce. One of the things since COVID that we've seen is really a remarkable amount of burnout in lots of sectors, but a lot in mental health too. So we're seeing more people leave the field, and as the demands are increasing, we're seeing it's harder for practitioners to be able to stay engaged in this work and to be able to provide the care that we need them to be able to provide when we know more folks are in need. So over the past 10 years within college counseling, what we've seen is really an increase in demand at counseling centers all across the country. So at MSU, when we think about that, people always say, well, MSU is growing, so that must be why you're having more clients, and we're far outpacing the rate of enrollment. And that's not uncommon. That's been shown across the country in counseling centers. And there are some unique things that we're seeing with the students who are coming in and accessing care and what they're presenting with. So some of those trends are related to increases in depression and anxiety. We've seen that over the past 8 years, as well as increases in threat to self factors. Again, this is when we're thinking about students who are actually accessing care. And threat to self is when we're talking about either non-suicidal self-injury or suicidal thinking. And those have really been some of what we've seen with more students needing to access care with that higher level of acuity. In the last year or two, we've seen an interesting shift in that, where those things have somewhat stabilized, and a significant increase in students who are presenting with histories of trauma. And that, I think, is something that we had started to notice here, and it was so validating when we kind of understood how that is bearing out in the data nationally, too, where more people are coming in with histories of trauma and the ways that that's influencing the concerns and their mental health needs and what they're showing. And then the last one that is increasing is experiences of discrimination. So for our folks, students who are experiencing discrimination based on gender identity, race, religion and disability, those four areas in particular, we're seeing in the national data that that's really making a difference, where they're starting to experience more mental health concerns, at the same time experiencing more of those experiences of discrimination. That is bearing out kind of in the national data too, which we all kind of know if we're just sort of aware of what people might be experiencing in our world and what's going on culturally, that those are some of the experiences that are also starting, we're starting to see in the data. Let me think about what were the other things on that, sorry. Oh, then the last thing I kind of wanted to talk about is how our campus has responded to some of these increased needs and what we're seeing. So it's challenging right now when we see kind of these increased needs and the increased demands. I think we all hear that when we're talking about the mental health needs that we're seeing in the college population, but more generally as well. MSU has done a lot, I think, to really try to look at this from a more holistic perspective, and from my this is my opinion, I would say that's our only way to really start supporting this more holistically, is to have more of that public health approach where we're also looking at outreach, prevention, that more holistic view, collaboration. And so the investment at MSU has been in some of those outreach programs. It's been in increasing staff at the Counseling Center. And then very exciting for me, I guess, would be the new Student Wellness Center that we're building. That is really the manifestation of how we're going to integrate all of these different services and really come together and try to have a more holistic approach to health and well-being on our campus, and also meeting the mental health needs of our students in that space as well. So with that, I'm going to pass it off to Rebecca to talk about her piece.
I just want to say that I appreciate the work that Betsy and the clinic they do on campus. It's pretty incredible, and the needs have been great, especially coming out of the pandemic. So thank you. What I want to talk about today is the work that I've been doing. I am a professor of counseling, and I've been here for 15 years in our counseling program. We train school counselors, marriage, couple, and family counselors, and mental health counselors. We take 24 to 30 students a year, and we graduate that same amount every year. So at any given point in the program, we have well over 50 students in our program. So as you can imagine, that's a lot of counselors graduating and getting out into the community, which leads me to my latest research that I've been doing that is something that's been very near and dear to my own heart. I grew up in a rural town in the Midwest, in a very small town. I grew up in a small area and had like 40 kids in my class, my graduating senior class, which I thought was very small. But when I moved to Montana, y'all more about this, I realized that there are a lot of small, very small schools in Montana. And when I moved to Montana, I realized that my perception of what rural was was very different than what we experience here. And so there's two concepts that really guide the work that I do. One of them is learning by doing. I believe that the best way to learn is to go out and do, and that fits well with our counselor training model. The second one is, if you've seen one rural place, you've seen one rural place. And those two concepts really guide the work that I do. I've had the opportunity about 4 years ago to partner with three other women, two of them are on our campus, and one is actually on the University of Montana campus, on a grant through the U.S. Department of Education. The grant is called Rural Mental Health Preparation Practice Pathway. We like to shorten it to RMHP3. The folks that I'm with are doing that with are Anna Elliott. She's a faculty member of the counseling program here on campus. Jane Downey, she's a faculty member in education who's very interested in rural education. And then Kirsten Murray is a faculty member in UM. So it's a very unique partnership in that we did bring in UM, I know, the other ones, to partner in this grant. And the reason being is that if you drive 15 minutes out of town, you'll understand why we needed UM to help partner on this grant. This grant is going to is focused on placing and finding a pathway to get our students to move to rural places and to become practicing counselors in those places. When we did the research, or when we were preparing for the grant and we were looking at our two programs and we took the data and looked back 3 years, when we put a map up and we put pins up, all of the students that were graduating were staying pretty well within Bozeman and Missoula. And they weren't fanning out, not even really by much, like 10 miles. It was pretty surprising, actually. I thought we were doing better than that, and then it was pretty humbling when we actually looked at the data. So we put together a process with this particular grant. This process is looking at two things. How do we decrease isolation? And how do we prepare them to work in a rural place? Those two things are the two main items that you see the most in the literature in terms of counselor training and some of the factors that are involved when you're trying to place counselors in rural communities. So we decided to form a rural counseling cohort that was not MSU, that wasn't UM, but they were the rural counseling cohort. This group meets together, they have training together. For the entire year that they're working together, there's 10 students. There's 5 from MSU, 5 from UM. They go through a rural life orientation process. I just got back from that. We were in Anaconda last week. We pick a different rural community every spring, and we go visit that community, and we invite individuals from the community to talk to us about their community. What is it like to live here? What are your mental health challenges? How do you approach it when crisis happens in your community? And so it teaches the students, in some sense, how to enter into a community. Then they're placed in rural communities. All of them have placements. That's partly why we needed UM as well. We can't hit the upper northern part of the state. Our program is an in-person program. And so we've got students placed in Arrowhead, Harrison, Gardner, 3 Forks, and so we're trying to fan out as much as we can. What's making it possible for the students to be able to do that, though, is part of the grant, all of the funding primarily goes to the students and goes to the program. It pays them while they're in this program. That is a factor that I think is important. What we're finding, and what's probably been really surprising to me, is that it's just as expensive for some of these students to live in some of our rural areas as much as it is to live here. Maybe not quite as much, but still quite difficult, or there's a lack of housing in those areas. And so the grant has allowed them to either figure out how to do some temporary housing, how to at least pay for hotels when they need it, when the weather might be prohibitive from them getting back to Bozeman. So they spend their internship in the community, and then they have a post-grad stipend as well, should they decide to stay in the community. So it's pre-training, training, and then they get some support to stay in that community. I'm happy to say that we just received another grant to continue the work. It's $4 million grant this time, and it's for 5 years again. And so we had to look at our data again. And this time, it was really surprising. When we looked at our data, we had 20 students who fully completed the program. That means they started, they went through the pre-training, they went through their post-grad. Of those 20 students, we have a 75% persistence rate in the rural communities, which I think is astounding. We did not expect that. We weren't sure. We were kind of hoping for about 50%. And so when we saw that it was at 75%, that was really encouraging to see that. That doesn't mean that they're all in rural Montana. We have had some folks who've left us for Wyoming and other places. But they are still in rural places, which I think says a lot about a process that seems to be working to get them to be interested in, to move to get training in, and to persist in rural communities, because some of those communities are some of our most vulnerable communities. What we do know about rural schools is that 24% of our schools in Montana do not have a school counselor, and that 24% are rural schools. And so we're really excited to see that we've had Harrison is one of those schools that did not have a school counselor, and we have had someone there this year, and we're working on trying to continue that into the next year. So it takes me back to what I started with, learning by doing. And when you've seen one real place, you've seen one real place. And those two pieces, those two concepts have been real guiding factors in the work that we've been doing.
Thank you very much. I just want to thank you both for the work you're doing, especially the applied work. So I'm Dr. Bryce, I'm an associate professor in the psychology department. My background, I guess the best way to describe where I'm at now is to talk a little bit about where I came from. So my degree is in applied developmental psychology with a specific training on developmental psychopathology. Essentially what that means is I look at both the typical development of youth and also adults going throughout the lifespan and atypical development. So essentially looking at where children and adolescents go awry and how we can put them back on track. Part of that is looking at such things as risk factors, such as having adverse childhood experiences or different types of lack of peer support, family support, social support, but also resilience. So taking kind of a strength-based approach to that in terms of finding factors that do help them to get through hard times and adversity that they may experience throughout their life. So my first experience, I'm actually from a very rural town myself in Texas, and I have to agree with you, I did not go rural until I moved here. I just thought I did. And so I do have an understanding of essentially very similar to Montana, but there are definitely differences of kind of the challenges to providing psychological care or even psychiatric care to rural communities, especially when it's not easily accessible. My first research experience, though, my particular research, I guess I'll start with there, is understanding the risk factors of anxiety disorders, though it has moved into depression as well. And with living in Montana, doing research here, has also kind of carried over into suicide risk factors and resilience factors for that as well. Part of that came from actually my early experiences in my graduate program at the master's and PhD level. In 2005, when Hurricane Katrina hit, I actually was living in East Texas. We had a lot of people that evacuated and survivors that were there for probably 1 to 2 years. So during our community clinic that we had at the school that I was at, we saw clients that had experienced where they lost everything. Interestingly, when I got into my PhD program, I was at the University of New Orleans, and I started there in 2008. And so I started to get to work with these, not just people who evacuated, but actually youth who had experienced Hurricane Katrina, and really just started to understand the health disparities and health inequities in terms of the ability to evacuate. So most of the schools that I worked with were 99% black youth. And most of them had not had the resources or ability to leave. So they had saw many traumatic events. Even some of them reporting water to the second and third stories of their homes and even having to swim in that. And so, though my work today doesn't really focus on PTSD or traumatic experiences, I did carry that with me. And a lot of my work still today is driven from that, of really understanding how these adverse childhood experiences, such as traumatic events or even other things that make it be considered aversive, affect us in the long term, affect our youth in the long term. So I kind of have two arms in my research. One arm actually was looking at and still looks at how children regulate their emotions and how that plays a role in the development and also the maintenance of anxiety disorders over the lifetime. I believe that emotions are critical. Thoughts and behaviors are definitely important, and I think we've established that over 50, 60 years. But emotions and the way we regulate those emotions are not as well understood, or the particular strategies that we use to regulate those emotions. One way that I do that is through looking at psychophysiological measures, such as heart rate or arousal levels, to really understand how the body's reacting to these different types of adverse events that they have in their lifetime, or just even to the thoughts that they may have in the behaviors that they engage in, and how that puts them at risk or in resilience for anxiety disorders. But when I moved to Montana, my research has kind of shifted into the second arm, which I've been very excited about. Basically, we had a talk in our department where we have a couple of my colleagues who work with indigenous populations. And as they were giving this talk, they talked about anxiety, they talked about depression and this early trauma, but they really didn't talk about much research on it. So I started doing a little digging, a little bit asking questions, and come to find out there really isn't a lot of research on anxiety and depression in indigenous populations, especially in indigenous youth. So I was lucky enough, the program, the Clinical Translation Research Program, is no longer in existence, but they were lucky to get the developmental grant to work with the indigenous community here in Montana. And so I've been working with the Chippewa Cree Tribe at the Rocky Boy Reservation for the last 6 to 7 years. We use a community-based participatory research approach where essentially the community is research partners. So instead of being participants that we do research on, we actually partner with them to design the research studies, to come up with the questions that we want to ask, to implement the study, and then also to look at the results and findings and give us interpretations of what exactly they think that we're finding and what we're seeing. The great part about this community-based participatory research, though, is that because you're kind of face-to-face with them all the time, you start to kind of get integrated into their culture and start to understand some of the things that may be different from our culture. There's some things that I've found over the years that are very similar, but then I've also found things that are very different and may not always apply to them as they would apply to rural Montanans that are non-indigenous. And so during this time, we've actually conducted a study that was funded to really understand anxiety and depression in their youth. We started off with 3rd through 6th graders, and we plan to go all the way through 12th grade. We currently have a grant through the Center for American Indian and Rural Health Equity here at MSU that's funded by NIH. That grant is to work with the community to culturally redesign or adopt a previous prevention intervention program for anxiety to be intended to actually cover anxiety and depression in youth within the Rocky Boy schools. And so we're actually in our kind of phase one of that. We're actually hoping by this summer we'll be able to redesign that intervention program. It's a previous evidence-based program particularly for their culture, for their youth, and that they hope will help their people moving forward. And then our plan is to get more funding from the National Institute of Health to continue that work and to do a full test of that intervention. For me, again, this has been kind of life-changing. I would say it's not just been like a research change in the way I do things, but it has been especially a change for me life-wise. I'm really thinking about how anxiety and depression may look in different cultures, that it may be, you know, not just the same, and that we may describe things a little bit differently, may experience different symptoms than what they may be experiencing. And so our interventions may have to be tailored a little bit different for indigenous populations. And this can actually be applied not just for indigenous population, but even my past experience in New Orleans, also to Black populations or people from different races or ethnicities. And so that's kind of been my focus for the last 6 years and continues to kind of be my main focus. One of the things I find so special about that too is that, again, they get to be part of the process, and that empowers them. It feels like they are actually taking control of the research. They're not just becoming research subjects, like I said, or research participants. And due to that, we really come up with some great ideas. And I have always been a believer, and I tell my students this as well, that I don't want to be a great dictator. I want to be a great leader. And leader means listening to other people, listening to people in the community. And my business partners, what I always tell them is, you know your kids. I don't know your kids. I don't know how they're raised or what their likes are, what they do on a day-to-day basis, but you do, right? And no matter what this research comes out and kind of says, you know, and there's this kind of business knowledge of what works and doesn't work. what we need to do is provide evidence for policymakers to provide more money and funds to pay for that, right? They like data. They like to see that. And so that's kind of where my research comes in terms of mental health, is really to provide that data to make those changes in policy and to get that funding for the populations that I work with. One other thing, I'll just end with this. The other thing that I did, the last thing was, when I actually worked with the Center for Mental Health Research and Recovery, so I'm great, really glad that's coming back. But when I did work with it, I did work with schools here in Montana, rural and more urban schools, with the Youth Aware Mental Health Program, which I don't know if any of you have heard of that, but YAM is actually a suicide prevention program for schools. It's been, I believe, at least since I've been here, I've been here 8 years, maybe even longer, that it's been in our school districts. Mm-hmm. And essentially, when I worked with that program, it was really great to see that we're taking steps forward and that our community and our state is putting money into suicide prevention. Because as a developmental psychologist, one of my kind of, I would say, pet peeves is really prevention intervention. If we can start it before it actually happens, that may be more helpful than after it's already started, right? It may be a little bit easier for them to kind of start to build the coping skills and strategies they need to deal with the problems that they may face. And so that's kind of been my thing. And I'll leave it at that.
Was the one non-professor, non-researcher up here. I have to say, I have total admiration for all the work that you three are doing insofar as really ensuring we have a workforce 5, 10, 20 years from now, and it's deployed in a way that's meaningful, and that the current health and safety of this student body is closer to what it should be, so that Montana does have the brightest future possible. That's amazing. You all are very deliberate, structured, and organized, and I admire it and envy that. Because in contrast, I think I am more apt to rush into something that's shiny, new, and has movement associated with it. If you were to give me a dissertation or a thesis as my core assignment, which stood between me and a degree, I would immediately enter catastrophic thinking and be done. Is Dr. Kushner connected? Okay, great. Okay. So I will try and keep this relatively short. You'll let me know if I keep it sweet. Insofar as giving a general feel of what I do, Bob Seitz, I'm a physician, boarded in addiction psychiatry, addiction medicine, as well as general psychiatry. And I do head 406 Recovery. We're a Montana nonprofit dedicated to treating substance use disorders as well as general psychiatric concerns that co-occur with substance use disorders. Tons of co-occurrence in that 2/3 of individuals who have a substance use disorder have a non-substance use disorder psychiatric illness. The reason I got into this space primarily was it was very obvious to me in seeing how services were being provided across communities, and this goes back to my training at University of Washington in Seattle, it would be as if you go to a mechanic. As a customer, you expect a full service experience. If something's wrong with your transmission, it will be addressed, properly diagnosed, and fixed. If not, where are you going? You go to a place and they say, oh, all we do here is oil changes. You say, that's not a mechanic, this is Jiffy Lube. No offense to Jiffy Lube, they do it fine. But they have truth in advertising and declare what they're doing up front. I'd say similarly, given the prevalence of substance use disorders, here in Montana, by far and away, alcohol use disorder reigns supreme, as it does throughout the nation. Methamphetamine use disorder is not that far behind, and unfortunately, we are catching up with the nation when it comes to opioid use disorder, especially fentanyl abuse. And in particular, as a psychiatrist, acknowledging that abundant need for treatment, for me, serving communities across Montana through the work we do at 406 Recovery, it's essential to have that service offering. So I'm partnering with Dr. Reedbach, who also is addiction psychiatry, addiction medicine, Dr. Mark Mantel, who's based out in Missoula. He's family medicine, addiction medicine, a psychopharmacologist, Michelle Reinhardt, who was at Billings Clinic for 10 years, overseeing the inpatient psych unit, and four nurse practitioners. We've created a core team, and we are launching into several partnerships. We're with RIMROC Foundation as of June 1st. We'll be providing all of their psychiatric care and a portion of their substance use disorder treatment. We're doing a series of educational events with the likes of Eastern Montana Community Mental Health Center and making sure that their workforce is proficient in core psychiatric diagnoses, not only substance use disorders, but other things that commonly co-occur, which is basically the entire TSM. Insofar as really giving a feel for perhaps why this matters more now than it did just 5 years ago, I would highlight COVID-19 and co-occurrence. COVID-19 really facilitated behavioral health advancing to the present in its adoption of tech. Specifically, when we think about telehealth and the apt use of technologies that have been there for some time, many of us were probably speaking with loved ones by Skype 10, 15 years ago. Finally, we're seeing good uptake of telehealth, and it's made a huge difference here in Montana, as we are one of the most rural states. And it is a delusion to think we can offer in-person care across the state. That's not happening. What is a meaningful aspiration is to ensure that we're delivering quality care, agnostic to whether it's telehealth or in-person. And so often, it's not a choice between in-person versus telehealth, it's telehealth and nothing. That's what we see time and time again. In COVID-19, I was at Billings Clinic to start, where I served as medical director of the psychiatric stabilization unit, saw incredible acuity that raged through COVID-19. We had to stand up a telehealth practice. Otherwise, we basically couldn't see patients. And that was meaningful to see, because you see that organizations can adapt and change, even though there's incredible rigidity if they must and they have no other option. Also saw through that work, there was an incredible opportunity in telehealth and to make a difference here in access to care, specifically for psychiatric services. I was one of the principals and founders of what I think still is today the largest telepsychiatry practice in the state and the region. In transitioning to this nonprofit launch, really wanted to focus on the patients who have the greatest burden of mental health concerns, which are substance use disorders and co-occurring. And as a nonprofit, what's cool is we get to take on some of the more complex cases, whereas the reality of for-profit psychiatry oftentimes is you're always going to have an easier business, an easier time treating the worried well. It's not too compelling. I don't think that's something that many people go to medical school to do. So it's been really compelling to treat a high level of acuity, and increasingly we're seeing through the partnerships, we're able to get to more and more patients. We saw our first patient in October, and now we're approaching 1,000. Thanks in large part to our partnership with RIMROC.
Okay, we see that Dr. Kushner has joined us. So Dr. Kushner, we welcome you to the panel, and we just wanted you to have a chance to give us a 10-minute or so intro to your work and highlights of your work. And we're making your face big on the screen so everyone can see you right now.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks. Everyone for the invitation. My apologies that I couldn't be there with you in person on this great day. I wanted to try to talk a bit about an emerging concept that's increasingly important to many of us, that we call precision psychiatry. And it's not so much to talk about this specific term, but what is really meant by it. And perhaps I'll give an example that I think is illustrative of the concept that I'm talking about, what perhaps some of the pitfalls are and what some of the broader ramifications might be. So if you go back maybe 15 years or so, and continuing to this day, there's a disorder that many people are aware of, know about, called chronic fatigue syndrome. And patients with chronic fatigue syndrome have a whole variety of physical and psychological symptoms that can be very difficult to treat. Often present, and the healthcare providers that are very often taking care of them are very often family practice doctors. And essentially, if you sort of summarize it, and I'm making a generalization, but to a large extent, for the most part, this really turns out to be the case for the vast majority of those patients. All the medical workups and scans and tests and things that are done turn out to be normal, turn out to be, unremarkable. And this often leads the healthcare system to ascribe this disorder to be something of kind of psychological origin, psychiatric origin. And I don't mean that, in a way that we typically think of psychiatric. What I mean is that's given a prejudicial moniker. In other words, many of those patients are sort of designated to some extent by the medical community as essentially complaining of, and I use that word deliberately, symptoms that that are difficult to believe, let's say, by much of the medical community. And about 15 years ago, there was, I think, a really illustrative situation that happened that I wanted to just describe. Many of you may know this story. So there are a group of scientists around the world who are trying to understand this disease. And there's a woman named Judy Mikovits, who was at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, that was investigating basically, what is the pathophysiology? What is going wrong in the body that leads perhaps to this disease? And she published a paper in a journal called Science. It's a weekly magazine that, for many of us doing scientific research, is widely considered one of the most well-regarded journals in all of biology. And she published this paper in Science, essentially, from a relatively large cohort of patients with chronic fatigue syndrome and demographically matched individuals without. And what she essentially found was that there was a very rare kind of human endogenous retrovirus, a virus basically, that is responsible for chronic fatigue syndrome. And this paper generated a lot of publicity, a lot of conversation, a lot of discussion within the medical community, and was covered very widely in the public press. And what happened was that all of a sudden, with that diagnosis, with this discovery, all of a sudden opened the imagination and inspiration and motivation for so many people to start thinking about, okay, how can we now find a cure for this virus? How can the pharmaceutical industry do this? How at universities and in medical clinics, we need to have a test for that.
you know, earlier talking about COVID, you know, how can we develop a test for this to know, you know, who's affected by this virus, how can we treat it? And all of this kind of prejudicial, you know, stigma associated with this disease that previously, you know, medicine was not able to have a test for, a test, you know, that objectively determined this disease. All of a sudden, that was no longer the focus. And now there was, you know, a ton of enthusiasm and motivation to want to try to find, you know, a treatment and a diagnostic tool that was implementable within the clinic. And a couple months later, other groups of scientists around the world, as, you know, the scientific process goes, they, you know, looked at the patients that they had in their clinics who were diagnosed also with chronic fatigue syndrome and, you know, developed the test to be able to test for this virus. And slowly but surely, none of these other groups were able to replicate these results. And eventually a group of these scientists came back to UNLV and said, look, we're having a hard time replicating this. Can you help us, you know, to look at this and figure out what maybe we're doing wrong? Long story short, it turns out that report turned out not to be correct. And I won't get into the details of that. We can talk about it if anyone's interested, but, you know, in the interest of time, that report turns out not to be correct. And the paper was withdrawn. And we now know that's just, it's not the case. It's not the case that at least that particular virus is not responsible for chronic fatigue. And what happened was, then the entire field went back to the previous situation. And why do I tell this story? I tell this story because, you know, in the case of mental health writ large and mental illness, the stigma and the prejudice is so severe, it's so inherent and so intrinsic to our entire society, including, by the way, the entire medical community. And again, you know, I'm making a generalization, but I really think that it holds. And the point that I want to make from this story is that it's not that we're powerless against that. And, you know, there's a variety of different efforts being made, which are fantastic. And I just want to highlight, you know, one area where I think we have the potential to really make some real progress in that regard. And that, you know, comes from this story, which is during that phase, that short phase of time, when we simply thought that we knew what the cause of this disorder was, because we thought that it was due to this virus, the stigma and the discrimination that was going on not only evaporated, but actually it was almost 180 degrees turned around, that there was this tremendous amount of motivation and investment in the idea of trying to pursue that new knowledge for the betterment of that community of people who have chronic fatigue. And the moment that we no longer believed that that was the case, it all just completely evaporated and went back to, you know, this previous situation. The point that I want to make is that I bet heavily, and, you know, the investment in my own work, and I think we're going to see increasingly in, you know, the entire field, I'm far from alone in this belief, that in the next 5 to 10 years, I think we're really going to understand that psychiatric illness, at least for a subset of people, that it is a condition in which it's diagnosable using the classical medical model. In other words, that there are factors that are discernible using, whether it's lab tests or brain scans, conventional medical approach where we do, diagnostic tests that go beyond what in psychiatry is the traditional interviewing and phenomenologic evaluations, that we do blood tests and brain scans to make diagnoses. I think we're going to see that more and more. And what I want to say is that I think it's important that, at the level of community mental health, that we begin to be increasingly open to that likelihood. We make sure that we're thinking in advance about how to prepare ourselves for that, and that we're building a mental health system that will be amenable to that when those changes start to happen. I mean, I'll give you an example. I'm largely working in New York State, and when I go into the community mental health systems, particularly in the outpatient clinics that are, outside of, let's say, a hospital system, into the community outpatient clinics, phlebotomy just doesn't exist. Like, the ability to just take a, get a blood sample from, an individual patient doesn't exist in those clinics. They're not set up for that, and for good reason, because right now, in psychiatry, it's not that common that, for any given patient, for any given, outpatient visit, that we need, to get a blood sample. But what I'm saying is those times are changing, and I think it's something that really needs to start from, from the basics, which is we have to start to educate the public about the fact that psychiatric illness is no different than any other kind of illness. There's no magic. They are diseases of the brain. It's no different than having liver disease or heart disease. Second of all, we have to educate our students that these are brain diseases. We have to educate our psychiatric residents about really fundamentally how the brain works, even though, frankly, that's not really required in 2023 in order to practice standard of care psychiatry. And I think we have to start to build, relationships, on the research front, so that we can both contribute and, be in position to be able to implement a lot of these changes as they're happening. I'll stop here, because I think my time more or less is up. But I'll say, just to make this more concrete, I think there's two areas that we can really watch for in which the biology is very closely connected with disorders and where I think some of this testing is really going to happen. One is in the area of genetics. I think there's an increasing understanding of the, we would call, genetic architecture. In other words, what the modifications are in, in DNA that can really alter a person's risk for various psychiatric disorders. And the second, which is really, really interesting and emerging, is has to do with the relationship between the immune system and the brain, how inflammatory states, many of them medical conditions, how autoimmune reactions can really lead to what look like traditional classic presentations of psychiatric illness that turn out to be immunologic, inflammatory, or autoimmune disorders that are masquerading with the symptoms of psychiatric illness, and there's things that we really don't want to miss because they're otherwise treatable medical conditions. In the interest of time, I'm going to stop there. I deeply appreciate the invitation and the opportunity to speak and share some of these thoughts, and look forward to the discussion that's going to follow. Thank you.
So I want to thank our panelists. Why don't we do that together?
That was a symposium, Mental Health Resources and Research, a community symposium held on Montana State University's campus on Thursday, April 27th.